Hitler's War by David Irving. Chapter is Feelers to Stalin. While in the north Hitler's troops stood their ground, the Russian offensive swept over Novorossiysk, Bryansk, Poltava, Smolensk, Dnipropetrovsk, and on November 6th, Kiev itself fell. Man, that was a tough opening there. Army groups south and center had fallen back on the new Panther Line, primarily along the Dnieper River, but Stalin rapidly built up fresh bridgeheads here as well. Hitler stormed at General Zietzler, his chief of staff. Quote, "You see, I give you permission to build the Dnieper Line you were always asking for, and where is it? The troops found nothing ready for them." End quote. That much was true, but blame also attached to Hitler for his stubborn determination to keep the fighting as far from the Reich as possible. During 1942, he had belatedly encouraged the army to fortify the more stable sectors of the front using labor impressed from the local Russian population. Kluge had done little, causing Hitler to exclaim, after failure of Citadel, quote, "If only he had done some construction here instead of talking so much hot air and making explanations," end quote. Zietzler had been loath to allow Speer's Tot organization engineers to direct the East Wall project. Besides, the architect Speer had displayed in the Atlantic Wall project little of the inspiration and energy that distinguished the engineer Fritz Tot's work on the 1938 West Wall. Speer had his eye on more ambitious heights. His redesignation by Hitler early in September as Minister of Armaments and War Production led to authoritative rumors that Speer saw himself as a future Minister of War. Parallel to the high-level bickering over the construction of the East Wall ran a debilitating argument over the precise route it should follow. Zietzler had always favored following the Dnieper, as its western bank was a steep cliff towering off often 150 feet above the eastern plains. In summer, the river was a raging flood, sometimes 2 miles wide and virtually unbridgeable. But it was over 100 miles behind the lines, and Hitler had rejected such a fantastic view of the future. Now he had no choice. Yeah, that was a mistake. On August 12th, Zietzler ordered the army groups to start building the East Wall. It was to run from the Kerch Peninsula in the south to Lake Peipus and Narva in the north. The OKW, the Luftwaffe, and the Navy raised protests about this route. One of Barbarossa's original objects had been to push the closest Russian bomber airfields out of striking range of the Reich, while at the same time providing airfields from which the German bombers could devastate the Urals industrial industries. The Urals industries. There's no industrial there. In addition, abandoning the Black Sea naval base of Novorossiysk to the enemy would sour Germany's political relations with Turkey, Romania, and Bulgaria. If Zaporozhye could not be defended, then the loss of the hydroelectric power station there would make it impossible to operate the blast furnaces at Dnipropetrovsk. Thus, Speer's plan to establish a munitions industry in the Ukraine would collapse. The naval staff also objected. An east wall built from the Velikiye Luki, to Lake Peipus and Narva meant the final loss of Leningrad. The Russian fleet could again maraud in the Gulf of Finland and jeopardize the German Navy's training programs in the Baltic, and the import oil shales in Estonia would have to be written off. But Zietzler wanted a defensible east wall built by the end of October, and on September 4th he issued orders to the army groups to that effect. East of the line, the population and property along a 25-mile-wide belt was to be ruthlessly exploited for a project. A swath of total destruction in this zone must make it impossible for an enemy to survive there. Quote, "The outlying area must become a desert," end quote. Field Marshal George von Kukler, commander of Army Group North, came a week later to protest to Hitler. It would be like losing a battle, he said. His men had gained and valiantly defended their present lines at Leningrad in 2 years of bloody fighting. They would not like seeing the graves of thousands of their comrades abandoned to the enemy without good cause. Zietzler would not accept his arguments, but Hitler was clearly loath to act prematurely. As so often before, he postponed a decision. A split between West and East seemed inevitable. During August 1943, Ribbentrop had again extended feelers to the Russians. First, he had sent Rudolf Leichus to Stockholm to seek clues as to Stalin's peace terms. Then, in mid-August, he had ordered his subaltern, Dr. Peter Kleist, to pick up his earlier threads with a certain non-Aryan Baltic businessman in Stockholm, Edgar Klaus, known to have contacts with the Soviet embassy there. Klaus claimed that the former Russian ambassador in Berlin, Vladimir Dekhanazov, was coming in on September 12th and hoped to meet a German negotiator then. Kleist reported this to Ribbentrop at the Wolf's Lair on the 10th. Hitler proved more receptive this time. They went over to a map and he sketched in a possible demarcation line to be agreed on with Stalin. But during the night, he changed his mind and told Ribbentrop he would have to think it over more carefully. In conversation with Goebbels on the 9th, he had shown a greater affinity for the British than for Stalin. Hitler decided to wait until the Allies had been dealt the kind of military reverse that in Hitler's calculus must always precede a secret offer of armistice. Yeah, it's good to follow up with armistice after a victory. Operation Axis had been smoothly completed as planned. Rome had been seized. The disarming of Italy's armed forces was proceeding rapidly. In the Aegean, Rhodes, and Corfu, there was still fighting, however, and late on the 10th, an ultimatum was issued to all Italian troops to lay down their arms. Otherwise, their commanders would be shot as francs tireurs. Often, the Italians gave their arms to the partisans, particularly to Tito's guerrillas in Dalmatia. Wherever this was found to have occurred, Hitler had their officers stood before the German firing squads and the men deported to the Eastern Front to swell his army's labor force. Bent on surrendering their ships to the Allies, the Italian fleet had sailed on the 9th on a pretext. Luftwaffe bombers equipped with guided missiles sank the battleship Roma and injured her sister ship Italia. The rest defected. In Nice, a German officer was killed by an Italian hand grenade, and the railroad garrison was put before a firing squad in revenge. Badoglio had done his utmost to wound Germany. When the American Fifth Army's invasion at Salerno, south of Naples, began on September 9th, the Germans realized from American radio messages that their minefields had been betrayed to the enemy. An Italian naval lieutenant put the fuel dumps in Naples to the torch. Meanwhile, Badoglio, Ambrosio, and Roata had fled to the enemy, accompanied by the King and Crown Prince Umberto. With grim satisfaction, Hitler read the latest intercept of an Anthony Eden telephone call from London to Winston Churchill in Washington. Eden was indignant that Umberto was refusing to accept an English officer as aide-de-camp. As for the Duce, Badoglio had promised to relinquish him to the enemy. Hitler's heart went out to him, wherever he now was. Quote, "Understandably," Hitler was broadcasting to his people on September 10th, surrounded by Himmler, Goering, and his staff, "I am grieved by the sight of the unique injustice inflicted on this man, Mussolini, and the degrading treatment meted out to him, whose only care these last 20 years and more has been for his people, as though he were a common criminal. I was, and am glad, to call this great and loyal man my friend." End quote. It sounded very much like an obituary for Mussolini. Hitler had appointed a national government under Alessandro Pavolini to salvage what was left of fascism in Italy. SS General Karl Wolff was attached as police advisor, quote-unquote, to Pavolini. North of the Apennines, Italy was now officially, quote, German-occupied territory, unquote, with a military governor. To the south was the operations zone. Kesselring was ordered on the 12th to defeat the American divisions at Salerno if he could. If he could not, he was to fall back on Rome, blocking the enemy's path by destroying roads, bridges, tunnels, and railway installations as he retreated. On the 11th, the OKW ordered that everything of value in the south, goods and raw materials, was to be stripped and shipped north, quote, "on the behalf of the new fascist government," end quote. Speer persuaded Hitler to empower him to dismantle precious machine tools from anywhere in Italy, quote, "in danger of an air attack," end quote, and ship them back to the Reich. Mussolini's exit was therefore something of a relief. As Goebbels wrote, quote, "we must judge it all from the standpoint of expediency," end quote. On the 12th, two of Hitler's frontier Gauleiters came for lunch, Franz Hofer from the Tyrol and Friedrich Rainer from Carinthia. Hitler signed two additional decrees subjecting large provinces of northern Italy to their Gau administration. Thus, the future Germany was intended to reach the frontiers of Venetia. At what stage the startling news of Mussolini's rescue reached the Wolf's lair is uncertain. At 2 p.m., the fallen Duce was already free. Speer suggested that under the circumstances, the three decrees should be cancelled, but Hitler would not hear of it and changed their date from September 12th to 13th so that there could be no doubt that the Duce's liberation had not in the least affected his decisions on Italy's future. On 9:45 p.m., as he was supping with Himmler, an SS general telephoned from Vienna that Mussolini had just arrived there with Otto Skorzeny. According to a manservant, Hitler exclaimed, quote, "That'll show the British that I never turn my back on a friend. That I am a man of my word. They'll say he's a friend indeed." End quote. 2 days later, Hitler drove to the local airfield to meet the plane bringing the tired Italian dictator up from Munich. Mussolini was dressed in a simple dark blue suit. He was very different from the Mussolini who had conferred with Hitler in past years. He protested that he was still ill, and for a while Hitler believed that Mussolini had been poisoned too. But Morrell took him under his scrutiny and found nothing wrong with him. Hitler expected him to extract a terrible revenge on Count Ciano, Dino Grandi, and all who had betrayed the cause of fascism in July. A few days later, Edda Mussolini, Ciano's wife, who had been brought to Germany, appealed to Hitler for enough Spanish currency to enable her to immigrate with the Count through Spain to South America. But Hitler ruled that he was to remain in German hands. Besides, his agents had intercepted a threatening letter from Edda to her father. If the Duce did not take her out of Germany, this said, she would cause the name of her father to be cursed throughout the world. For hours, Hitler paced the map room with Goebbels, speculating on what Edda's hold over her father could be. Hitler advised the former dictator to put his family's affairs in order. To Ribbentrop's astonishment, Hitler also remarked to Mussolini that he planned a compromise with Stalin. But the next day, he changed his mind again. Quote, "You know, Ribbentrop," he said, "if I come to terms with Russia today, I would be at her throat again tomorrow. It's in my nature." End quote. Torn between Stalin and the West, when Goebbels asked if he refused to deal with Churchill on principle, Hitler retorted, quote, "In politics, you can't let personalities and principles stand in your way. It's just that Churchill is inspired by hate, not common sense." Unquote. He far preferred to deal with Stalin, but then Stalin could hardly grant the Reich what it demanded in the East. Hitler had now abandoned hope of throwing the American Fifth Army back into the sea at Salerno. Initially, the Americans had encountered only the 16th Panzer Division, but Richthofen's rocket-firing fighters and the 88mm guns of anti-aircraft regiment had wrought havoc on the invasion ships. On the 13th, two Panzer and one Panzer Grenadier Division began a counterattack and routed two American divisions, but the attack came under heavy bombardment from Allied warships. The beachhead remained, leaving Hitler's staff only to rejoice at the quote-unquote thrashing meted out to the Americans. Yodel set their value far below that of Montgomery's seasoned troops. American troops were, quote-unquote, usable, he said. But the rest, quote, never attack so long as a single gun is left firing from the German lines, end quote. Hitler wrote off the threat of an American invasion elsewhere for many months to come. Quote, "No more invasions for them. They are much too cowardly for that. They only managed the one at Salerno because the Italians gave their blessing," end quote. The bungling Allied planning comforted him greatly over the next weeks. Why did they not immediately invade the Balkans, where the natives were waiting for them with open arms? Why had they not ventured a bold invasion north of Rome when Badoglio defected? Italy's defection had greatly profited the Reich in terms of material. No longer did Germany have to feed Italy with coal, oil, and foodstuffs. By the end of September, the first 268,000 Italian prisoners had already been transported to the Reich. Operation Axis had also yielded a big haul of Italian weaponry. 449 tanks, 2,000 guns, and 500,000 rifles. The notes taken by one general staff officer attending the Führer conferences of September 30th reflect Hitler's astonishment at the booty made by his troops in Italy. Goering reported that they had found hundreds of Italian fighter planes. Quote, "How did these cripples manage it?" burst out Hitler. "The Italians and the Duce," responded Goering, "have been deliberately doing the dirty on us for years. They simply squirreled away raw materials and aircraft. The Duce ought to be shot," end quote. Hitler, however, felt that it was the king and his generals who were to blame. As for their strategy in southern Italy, he emphasized how vital it was to hold the enemy down there for as long as they could. Quote, "We've got to win time," he said. "The enemy are having a pretty thin time themselves. Their reserves of manpower and materials are subject to exactly the same limitations as our own, and sooner or later they are bound to get fed up with it. From a certain time onward, the war can't be won by conquering the whole world, but by dragging out the fighting so long that the others get worn out," end quote. Addressing Goering directly, he exclaimed, quote, "Time, time, time," unquote. After the author of these notes jotted down his own impression of this first meeting with the Führer, quote, "He looked tired and unwell. He is markedly bowed. From time to time, his belief in the propriety of his actions and in ultimate victory did come through. He ought to get rid of his entire entourage, however, as a matter of the utmost urgency." Unquote. Three heavy night raids had been launched against Berlin, but these failed to repeat the catastrophe of Hamburg. New freelance night fighting tactics introduced by fighter ace Colonel Hajo Hermann were proving effective. Goebbels' timely evacuation order spared the lives of many thousands. In the raid on September 1st, only 13 Berliners died. And in the final raid, two nights later, of 346 dead, only one was a child. Far worse was, however, expected. In the big cities, painted arrows were to be seen everywhere, telling the people which way to flee if firestorms broke out again. To the German people, the war in the air was the second front. By day and night, the Allied bombers ranged over Germany, sometimes as far as Danzig or East Prussia. From the newly captured airfields around Foggia in southern Italy, they could now reach any target in Austria and the Balkans. The American bombers were heavily armed, 18 of them in tight formation packed 200 heavy machine guns, a nightmare for attacking fighter planes. Hitler learned that the German fighters had still not been equipped with the 30mm cannon, although he had seen the prototype MK-101 demonstrated at Recklin in July 1939. He now ordered the fighters fitted experimentally with the 50mm anti-tank gun to enable them to open fire from well outside the bombers' defensive radius. The inadequacy of the current fighter armament sorely affected pilot morale, and this in turn was felt by the people. On October 4th, the Americans bombed Frankfurt on a brilliant autumn day, their glittering squadrons droning high over the city, quote, "as ours used to in peacetime," end quote. Hitler bitterly reproached Goering, saying that his Luftwaffe had lost the confidence of the people. Quote, "Whatever the cost, these mass daylight attacks have got to be stopped," end quote. The Reichsmarshal passed this rebuke on to General Gallant. Between them, Goering and Gallant brought discipline to the fighter squadrons and inflicted savage wounds on the American bombers in October. In 3 days' raids up to the 10th, the enemy lost 88 bombers and nearly 900 men, and when the Americans attacked the ball-bearing factories at Schweinfurt on October 14th, the day fighters brought down 60 and severely damaged 17 more. Meanwhile, at night, the battle ebbed and flowed. On the lakes around Berlin bobbed myriads of metal radar reflectors to deceive the bombers. Airborne receivers enabled the German night fighters to home in on the bombers' own powerful radar emissions. Their enemies fought back with decoy raids, splitting raiding forces, and German-speaking broadcasters countermanding the orders transmitted by the German ground controllers. The defenders resorted to unloading fake target flares over the open countryside, or they patrolled the enemy fields waiting for the bombers to return. Hitler impatiently demanded fresh raids on Britain's cities. Quote, "Aerial terrorism is only effective as a threat," he pontificated, "not in its actual fulfillment. How often these last 300 years have entire cities or great buildings been consumed by flames? The devastation actually works in our favor, because it is creating a body of people with nothing more to lose, people who will therefore fight on with utter fanaticism."
End quote. On October 22nd, the British generated a second firestorm. It ravaged Kassel and killed 6,000 citizens died between dusk and dawn. It made no impression on Hitler, but he intensified his pressure for the secret weapons to terrorize London. The A4 rocket, the flying bomb, and the multiple gun battery at Mimoyake near Calais, sinisterly known as the quote-unquote high-pressure pump. Early in October, Hitler dropped a broad hint to Goering that one of the big Allied occupied cities in southern Italy, like Brindisi or Taranto, should also be stricken by a heavy Luftwaffe night attack. This would remind Germany's other reluctant allies that allowing the enemy in was no passport to paradise. The increasing brutalization of the war showed itself in many ways. Early in October, the remaining Jews were deported from Denmark. Himmler evidently also considered the 8,000 Jews in Rome a potential threat to public order. Ribbentrop brought to Hitler an urgent telegram from his consul in Rome, reporting that the SS had ordered from Berlin that, quote, the 8,000 Jews resident in Rome are to be rounded up and brought to Upper Italy, where they are to be liquidated, end quote. Again, Hitler took a more moderate line. On the 9th, Ribbentrop informed Rome that the Führer had directed that the Jews were to be taken to Mauthausen concentration camp in Austria instead, where they were to be held as hostages, quote-unquote. Coincidentally, it was at this time that Himmler revealed to his SS Gruppenführer generals on October 4th and to the party's Gauleiters on October 6th that by the end of 1943, the last Jews in occupied Europe would have been exterminated. Speaking to SS generals on October 4th, 1943, Himmler praised the toughness of those who had to carry out the massacre. To the Gauleiters, he referred to, quote-unquote, the Jewish problem as the most difficult he had handled. Quote, the Jews are to be exterminated, was, he told them, easier said than done. And even where women and children were concerned, he, Himmler, had opted for a clear solution. Quote, I did not consider myself justified in exterminating the menfolk. That is to kill them or have them killed, while leaving their children to grow up and take vengeance on our sons and grandsons. The hard decision had to be taken to make this race disappear from the earth. End quote. That Himmler's intention was to make all his SS generals accessories after the fact to the massacre is strongly suggested by one curious document in his files, a name-by-name list of those who had not attended his speech. The magnetic recordings show that he did not yet claim to be acting on Hitler's orders. The same Gauleiters were Hitler's guests at the Wolf's Lair on October 7th. From this point on, he could probably no longer credibly plead ignorance of what his, quote, faithful Heinrich, unquote, had done. The SS stood high in Hitler's esteem that autumn. Without Kaltenbrunner's agents, Mussolini's rescue would have been impossible. Princess Mafalda had also been found and was languishing in a concentration camp. A useful hostage was to ensure the good behavior of the King of Italy. And there's an asterisk right there about the King of Italy. Or about Princess Mafalda. She would die in the American bombing raid on Buchenwald concentration camp. Okay, back up. Himmler had inspired his Waffen-SS troops, moreover, with a fanatic's loyalty to Nazi Germany. Late in October, he showed Hitler a passage in a recent letter from a young SS brigadier on the Eastern Front. Quote, if the others had not been there, I would so much have liked to tell the Führer how much his soldiers revere him and are devoted to him. Even if his orders sometimes seem merciless or cruel, when the order is, quote-unquote, hold on to the last man, one feeling is supreme among the men fighting for their fatherland with rifles in their hand, that they have, as their leader, a man second to the Lord God alone, end quote. This was Hermann Fegelein. A few days later, Hitler selected him as his liaison officer to Himmler. In June, he married Eva Braun's sister. A year later, he was facing Hitler's firing squad as a deserter in the ruins of Berlin. Oh. Quote, "The Führer is confident," said Bormann in a secret speech at this time, "but he is not just an optimist. In fact, he is on principle pessimistic as far as all reports to him are concerned. He no longer believes what is not proven to him. He is skeptical about every cable and dispatch he receives," end quote. Stalin was in a position of consummate strength, and thus he was in a position to dictate to the world. To this, Hitler knew only one reply, quote, "The most important thing is to keep up the fight and never falter, but spy out the enemy's weaknesses and exploit them without the least thought of capitulation or, quote-unquote, understanding. Who can guarantee that one day a bombshell won't burst among the Allies and that they will suddenly discover differences that they can't plaster over anymore?" End quote. When fresh feelers reached Hitler from Britain, he thrust them aside. On October 15th, Himmler's chief of foreign intelligence, Walter Schellenberg, learned that the British trade chief in Stockholm, David McEwen, had offered to come secretly to Germany for a conference, ostensibly on economic affairs. Himmler asked Ribbentrop to secure a decision from Hitler. Hitler forbade any consideration of such feelers. One reason for Hitler's rebuff to what seemed to be vague Allied feelers was that under Kesselring's command, the campaign in Italy was proceeding far better than he had dared to hope. Rommel, commanding Army Group B in the north, in northern Italy, had prophesied the total loss of southern and central Italy. Overawed by this warning, Hitler had refused Kesselring's appeal for two more divisions to be sent by Rommel to the south. With these, Kesselring might have routed the Allies, but even so, his defensive success was a setback for Churchill and Roosevelt. Hitler ordered a line south of Rome from Gaeta on one coast to Ortona, on the other to be fortified and held. Once again, Rommel had misjudged. A year later, Hitler recalled, quote, "In Italy, too, he predicted our collapse as being just around the corner. It still has not occurred. Events have proved him completely wrong and thoroughly justified my decision to leave Field Marshal Kesselring there. My view is that without optimism, you cannot be a military commander." End quote. To Hitler, it was plain that Rommel was still tormented by his defeat in Africa. It would be better to give him another command far from Italy. Sent for by Hitler on October 17th, Rommel again cut a gloomy figure. A few days later, Hitler gave Kesselring a fresh hearing, and on the 28th, he decided in his favor. Rommel would be withdrawn from Italy and given a different assignment, as yet undecided. On October 23rd, 1943, the main attack on the 6th Army's sector of the East Wall, the southernmost portion, began. The next day, Melitopol was overrun. Kleist and his commanders lost their nerve. A headlong retreat began. Farther north, a gap was torn in the German lines between Dnipropetrovsk and Kremenchuk, which that was to yawn 100 miles wide within 2 weeks. Hitler appealed to Marshal Antonescu to rush Romanian divisions to help to stem the Soviet flood, but Antonescu feared for the 7 divisions he already had committed to the Crimea, where along with 2 German divisions, over 210,000 troops might any day be cut off from their overland supplies. In a reply received on October 27th, the marshal advised Hitler to get out of the Crimea while the going was good. Hitler demurred. Abandoning the Crimea without a fight would not impress Turkey or Bulgaria, and it would bring Stalin 250 miles closer to the Romanian oil fields, to the Romanian oil wells and refineries on which the Reich relied. With this in mind, on the day he received Antonescu's reply, Hitler summoned Goering, Donitz, and Zietzler and Jodl to a special war conference at 4:30 p.m. Zietzler was optimistic that the Crimea had enough munitions to survive. Admiral Donitz agreed that a later seaborne evacuation of the 17th Army from the Crimea would be possible, although the job would be a long one and risky because of the powerful Russian Air Force. Hitler, Donitz, and the Reichsmarschall were unanimous in believing that the Crimea must be held, and in the meantime provisioned by sea. Zietzler, quote-unquote, indicated his agreement. The records are plain on this score. 4 days later, the Crimea was cut off. The war conferences of October 27, 1943 vividly illustrated the complexities of fighting wars on many fronts with dwindling resources. Pitched battles were being fought with communist insurgents and guerrillas in the Balkans,
At night, the skies of Europe were angry with bomber engines. Speer needed workers to clear rubble, build factories, and operate machinery. Milch needed manpower for his new aircraft industry. Above all, Hitler needed fresh divisions to repair the breaches in the Eastern Front. In September, he had already had to lift the draft deferment allowed to the sole surviving sons of families. On October 27th, while strolling in the woods around the Wolf's Lair, Goering put in a plea for his aircraft factories to be spared the axe. He gave Hitler a concrete example of the shortage of manpower. Willy Messerschmitt, he said, had bluntly told him that for want of 4,000 workers, his ME-262 jet would be held up by 6 months. According to Goering, Hitler, quote, almost had a heart attack, unquote, on hearing this news. In his own lively imagination, Hitler had already assigned this jet bomber a key role in stopping any Allied invasion attempt. In his mind's eye, he could see the hours of utter chaos on the beaches as Allied landing craft arrived. His own troops would be pinned down in their bunkers by heavy naval and air bombardment. The air would be full of enemy fighters. At this moment, his new jet bombers should appear, thundering along the beaches with cannon blazing, hurling bombs at random into the jammed invasion troops, spreading panic and confusion for vital hours until he could bring up his mobile reserves. Goering promised the Führer he would get his jet bombers by May. Hitler's strategic thinking had undergone a startling change since Italy's defection. Goering portrayed it thus to his generals on October 28th, quote, "In Russia, we have won an immense outlying area in which we can resort to flexible tactics," he said. "Whether the Russians are at Krivoy Rog or approach 100 miles closer to us or not is not vital. What is vital is that by spring, at the latest, we can muster enough maneuverability to stand fast in the west and stop the second front before it starts. Only air power can do that. The Führer made this abundantly clear yesterday in Dönitz's presence." The Führer says the jet fighter with bombs will be vital, because it will hurtle at top speed along the beach at just the right moment and hurl its bombs into the throngs forming there. End quote. Goering added, I thought to myself, who knows if we will really have the ME-262 by then, end quote. If an enemy army ever set foot on French soil, concluded Goering, it would spell the end for Germany. Whereas if every German city was in ruins, the German people would still survive to fight on. In a wordy report to Hitler, Field Marshal von Rundstedt reached the same conclusion. Any German retreat in the west would provide the enemy with harbors that he needed and deprive Germany of her U-boat bases and coastal convoys. At Hitler's conference on October 30th, Jodl supported Rundstedt's main contention that a spring 1944 invasion of France was a certainty, because only the loss of the Ruhr would finally defeat Germany. Besides, Churchill would want to neutralize the A4 missile sites in northern France. Hitler agreed. Indeed, he went further, for he secretly ordered Rundstedt to send a team to reconnoitre a possible second line to be defended along the Somme and Marne rivers down to the Swiss frontier, which implicitly assumed that all of France would be overrun by the enemy. There's an asterisk there. This order again dispels the legend that Hitler was loath to allow timely provision for retreats. The proposed line still left Germany with the French provinces Hitler had decided in 1940 to annex. Back up. He also found a neat solution to the Rommel-Kesselring dilemma. On November 5th, he told Rommel that his Army Group Headquarters staff was to inspect the western coastal defenses and suggest how they could be improved, at the same time to study ways and means of mounting counteroffensive against an enemy lodged in Western Europe. Rommel was piqued by what seemed such an uninspiring mission, far from the limelight in which he had fought his famous battles. He wrote a few days later, quote, "Nobody knows if a new job is a way of shelving me or not. The Führer said quite the contrary. The envious are legion," end quote. His admiration for Hitler spurred Rommel on. On November 8, 1943, the Führer delivered his annual address to the Old Guard in Munich's Löwenbräu beer cellar. Quote, "What power he radiates," wrote Rommel in intoxication. "What faith and confidence he inspires in his people," end quote. And that's the chapter.